How to say wiretap in French and Spanish today, Monday, October 21st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. France and Mexico demand an explanation from the U.S. about new revelations concerning the NSA surveillance of foreign nationals. Hardly news in cynical France, but still.
Statements have to be made. Everyone has to say that he's appalled, and ambassadors have to be called in and reprimanded.
And in Mexico, a balance of outrage and caution.
The Mexican government is very careful about this. They do step out and condemn it officially, but that's all you get, a little slap on the hand.
And later, a journalist in Colombia takes her kids to a national park that used to be rebel-controlled and too dangerous to visit.
I'm Colombian, and I live here all my life, 44 years, and it's the first time that I can show them this freedom.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates premieres October 28th at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's a familiar story by now. Foreign government demands American explanation. This after new spying revelations from NSA leaker Edward Snowden. Make that two angry foreign governments today, France and Mexico. In just a moment, we'll hear from Mexico. First, though, we turn to France, where the newspaper Le Monde writes that the National Security Agency swept up some 70 million French phone records in a 30-day period. Christopher Dickey is the Paris bureau chief for the Daily Beast. And Christopher, tell us what the U.S. was exactly looking for in those 70-plus million communications.
Well, the United States is scooping up as many communications as it can around the world, including those of its allies like France, and a lot of communications that, in fact, involve American citizens. As we know, that's been the scandal of the last several months. What they do is vacuum everything up and then filter a lot out, just trying to keep the particular communications that have certain keywords in them. We don't know exactly what those keywords are, but you can guess they are Al-Qaeda or sometimes things that are more banal, like a special wedding, which was code that Al-Qaeda used to use for instance, the 9/11 attacks.
So the NSA drags its net through the shoals of information. Did they find anything?
You know, that's what we don't know from all these Snowden revelations. The impression is that they find absolutely nothing, and then they wave the flag and say, oh, well, we've stopped this or that terrorist attack, but we can't really tell you any of the details. You know, if they want to find things, they have to do it this way, because almost all major communications now are carried over fiber optic cables, and it's not the kind of thing where you can just sort of put, alligator clips on a wire. You have to suck it all in and then filter most of it out. And the resulting process is a very messy one and one that invades everybody's privacy, but they frankly don't know any other way to do it.
I mean, once it's revealed that the NSA does that to a country, it's not what's found necessarily that upsets people. It's just a perception that they did it. So how are the French feeling today?
Well, you know, there is a large reserve of anti-Americanism here that gets tapped into, as it were, by this kind of revelation. But the French are also sort of cynical about the whole business of intelligence gathering. They have a very significant spy service themselves. And in fact, Le Monde, which broke this story about the latest revelations concerning the NSA in France, also broke a story several months ago saying that the French intelligence services were doing exactly the same thing to the French people. So I think that there's a certain level of cynicism here. But of course, there's also always a knee-jerk anti-American reaction.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, it's one thing to have your own government spying on you, but this is not their government. It's another government, notably one with which the French have this notorious love-hate relationship.
Well, that's right. And you can say, you know, the French and the Americans are the best of enemies or the worst of friends. They're constantly spying on each other, in fact. I mean, my friends in the intelligence services told me years ago that there are several friendly countries that they worry about spying on the United States. One of them is Israel. Another is France.
I mean, one other thing about this episode and this revelation is that how much does it hit the French really where it hurts? Because aren't the French really concerned about their own government spying on them, regardless of recent revelations?
Well, the French, of course, are concerned about the government spying on them, but they also sort of cynically believe it does. What the French really worry about, traditionally, is people in their own family finding out what they're doing. And it's very funny that one of the characteristics of French telephone bills for years, dating back to the time when there were landlines for everybody, was that they didn't tell you exactly who had been called on that telephone. They might tell you a few digits, but it was like a credit card number, only partially revealed, because, among other things, spouses didn't want their opposite numbers to know who they were calling, lest they be having an affair and it be discovered. Mm. So it was. It sounds terribly French, and is. My own phone bill now has virtually no information about any specific calls.
Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief for the Daily Beast. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco. Always a pleasure.
Let's turn to Frank Contreras now. He's a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Last week, we spoke with you, Frank, about how grateful Mexico was to the U.S. for being the deal maker on the soccer field and getting Mexico another crack at qualifying for the World Cup. But over the weekend, we learned that the NSA had been spying on former Mexican President Felipe Calderón. So on the turn of a dime, we've gone from love to serious dislike. Is that the reaction in Mexico to this news?
That's how it looks from here. And in fact, pretty much that sums up the relationship as it's gone for decades, Marco.
And how's the government feeling about these revelations? I mean, it was the government that was being spied upon, after all.
The Mexican government, according to these revelations, was being spied on since 2010. During that year, as you pointed out, Marco, Felipe Calderón was the president of Mexico, and he was undertaking a major war against drug trafficking organizations and getting a lot of support from the United States government. So they really wanted to know, you know, was he staying on the right side, or were there people in his administration who were being pulled over to the drug traffickers' side because of corruption?
I mean, Calderón and the U.S. Were not just allies. There's also allegations that the same email monitoring system that was being used to gain information on the drug cartels was also being used on the president, Felipe Calderón.
That's what the evidence seems to reveal at this stage. I should also point out that at that time, just a few years before all of this was taking place, the Mexican government itself opened laws that allowed its own government to do that kind of spying on its people, the kind of thing that you saw with the Patriot Act in the United States. Very similar language in the legislation that came forward giving Mexico that opportunity to do that. And so this sort of thing was taking place, the Mexican government looking at its own people, but apparently also the United States. And it happened on three separate occasions, at least according to the documents that are coming forward.
So now current President Enrique Peña Nieto, I mean, he's in the hot seat now. What's been the reaction to revelations that the NSA was spying on the highest office in Mexico?
On the international tone of how countries like France, for example, have been reacting, you know, such a strong call out, bringing the U.S. ambassador over to talk to the foreign ministry in France. You know, Mexico is taking a quite lighter touch. We know that the Mexican economy would absolutely collapse without strong relations with the United States. Still, 80% of everything Mexico exports to the world is going to the United States. So, you know, the trade ties are tremendous. So the Mexican government is very careful about this. They do step out and condemn it officially, but that's all you get, a little slap on the hand.
You know, Frank, it's interesting. The headline about the surveillance in France seems to be 70 million French phone records got snagged in the NSA net. And Mexico seems somewhat different, in which we've got the president, who was an active player in the drug war, even an alleged target at one point of the drug cartels. He's being spied upon. Are any Mexicans saying that, you know, hey, Calderón worked politics at such high levels, he should expect such scrutiny?
From here in Mexico, people aren't that surprised, Marco. The United States used Mexico City back in the days of the Cold War. This was the major spy hub in Latin America for the United States government. This was, of course, a place where intelligence operations were coordinated, looking over all of those wars that were taking place in Central America at the time.
Just curious, Frank, does anyone in Mexico City today remember what the U.S. did on the soccer field last week?
Not much right now, Marco.
Journalist Frank Contreras reporting from Mexico City. Always great to speak, Frank. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco. A pleasure.
For the past 50 years, huge areas of Colombia have been off limits, too dangerous for tourists because of the country's long guerrilla war. But now security is improving as the government and FARC rebels negotiate a peace treaty. So Colombians have started to explore the mountains and jungles that used to be war zones. Reporter John Otis has been covering the conflict since 1997. He recently traveled with his wife and children to a national park in what was once rebel-controlled territory.
We've just arrived in La Macarena, where FARC guerrillas were once in charge of everything, from collecting taxes to imposing rough justice. During one of my reporting trips here in 2002, the FARC executed six town residents. My wife, Alejandra, who is a Colombian journalist, has her own harrowing memories of this place. Her father was held hostage by the FARC until her family cobbled together a ransom payment. Years later in La Macarena, Alejandra met a FARC commander who seemed strangely familiar with the whole story.
Suddenly we started to talk, and he asked me, "What's your name?" And when I said my name, he opened his eyes, and I realized at this moment that he was the guy who kidnapped my father.
So why would we want to come back here once again, this time with our 5 and 8-year-old sons? For one thing, the guerrillas have been driven out by the Colombian army. The town also sits next to La Macarena National Park, which has spectacular canyons, crystalline rivers, and world-class swimming holes. For years, fearful tourists stayed away from the park, but now they're flocking here. Like Bogota business consultant Juan Gonzalo Vallejo.
It's like a family jewel that has been lost for decades, and if only one day you find it and it's open for everyone, and it's time to enjoy that jewel.
About 10% of the townsfolk now work in restaurants and hotels or as tour guides. Edwin Lopez drives tourists around La Macarena on his motorcycle taxi.
La gente decían que eran terroristas, que eran guerrilleros, milicianos.
People used to say that residents of La Macarena were guerrillas and terrorists, he tells me. But now, thanks to tourism, the image of the town has changed. Improved security is largely due to the 8,000 soldiers housed at an army base on the edge of town. It's home to helicopters and a firing range. But what makes the biggest impression on my 5-year-old son, Lorenzo, is a photo display of FARC fighters as young as 13. He points to a picture of a gun-toting teenager and says she shouldn't be in the war.
Esta es la tierra de las oportunidades.
General Carlos Rojas is the base commander. He calls La Macarena a land of opportunity. If the guerrillas sign a peace accord, he predicts that many more areas of Colombia will open up for tourism. Still, the country has been at war since the 1960s, so it's sometimes hard to imagine a peaceful Colombia. Reminders of the conflict are everywhere. While out hiking, we stumble upon a rusty antenna from a now-defunct guerrilla radio station. When we try to tour the Guayabero River, boat drivers tell us rebels are upstream and that it's not safe. So, we repair to the hotel swimming pool, but even here, an army chopper hovers overhead. That's why La Macarena's makeover feels fragile. All it would take is a single kidnapping or rebel bombing to bring the tourism bonanza to a halt. But at least for the moment, thousands of Colombians, including my wife and children, are finally getting to know their country a little better.
To show our kids those beautiful places, for me, it's unforgettable. I'm Colombian, and I live here all my life, 44 years, and it's the first time that I can show them this freedom.
I used to breathe a sigh of relief when departing rebel-held towns like La Macarena. Now, as we check our bags for the flight home, I wish we could stay a little longer. For the world, I'm John Otis, La Macarena, Colombia.
You can see John's pictures from La Macarena, including one of his son being helped by Colombian soldiers. That's at PRI.org. Still to come on the show, the face kissed by millions on the world from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates premieres October 28th at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Israel has long boasted of having the world's highest number of high-tech startups per capita. Now Israel's president is looking to use that high-tech prowess to start up something else. New research focused on the human brain, which is why brain technology movers and shakers from all over the globe convened in Israel recently to show off the gadgets they're developing to tap into our craniums. The world's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Israel's 90-year-old president is obsessed with the brain. He even has this kind of wacky idea to build an Einstein museum in the shape of the Jewish physicist's brain. President Shimon Peres told an audience of brain researchers why gray matter matters.
We have a brain on our shoulders that makes our decisions for us without asking us, without explaining to us how does it do it. And we go around wondering. We're strangers to ourselves.
His vision is to turn Israel into a factory of neuroscience, modeled after Israel's successes in high-tech startups. So he presided over last week's first Israeli brain tech conference. An international committee of judges, including Nobel laureates, awarded $1 million to a team from Brown University, led by John Donahue, director of Brown's Brain Institute. His award? A bronze brain.
This is quite an awesome-looking award.
It's really cool, yeah. It's really amazing.
Doesn't look like the Oscar, but... Like...
Oh, it's better than the Oscar.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Donahue's brain gate sounds fantastical.
We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better. Stronger. Faster.
That's actually not so far off. BrainGate helps paralyzed patients move a robotic arm with their mind.
The idea of the technology is to implant a tiny sensor into the brain. This little sensor picks up patterns of activity, electrical impulses, that get translated into a command signal. And it can mean simple things like move the arm up, right, left, up or down.
There were other cool brain technologies on display at the conference, though some of them were mostly for fun. One Israeli gadget uses brain waves to help compose music. Here's what my brain sounds like. Yeah, my brain's kind of a snoozer. Another new technology, out of Austria, called Intendix, actually reads your mind. You stare at a digital keyboard and spell out words onto a screen just by thinking about each letter. It's to help paralyzed people who can't talk communicate. Gunter Kraus gets me outfitted for a demo.
I'm putting the cap on your head, and this is used to keep the electrodes in position.
Okay, here we go.
All right.
There's still a huge gap, by the way, between what we know about the brain and what we can do with that knowledge to make us, well, bionic. But we're slowly getting there. Even Gunter Kraus couldn't believe how well his mind-reading cap worked as the computer guessed what letters I was spelling out in my head. For
W. Oh, yes.
Yes?
R. L.
Whoa.
D.
D, all right.
The world.
I'm Daniel Estrin, Tel Aviv.
It's a problem any country would envy, too many jobs. But that's exactly what the Canadian province of British Columbia is dealing with. Too many jobs, not enough skilled tradespeople. Last year alone, 30,000 construction jobs went unfilled in British Columbia. So the BC Construction Association is running job fairs next week in Dublin, Ireland, and Belfast, Northern Ireland. Abigail Fulton is the group's vice president.
The nice thing about the Irish is they have a really excellent training system for the construction trades. The culture is not that different. They speak English, which is helpful, particularly from a safety perspective on construction sites. And they also have a mentality of working abroad. I think you'll find the Irish, there's a lot more Irish outside of Ireland.
The association is hoping to hire 600 skilled workers in Dublin and Belfast. One who's already made the journey is Danny O'Sullivan. He was a machinist in the Irish city of Cork, but about 2 years ago, he was laid off. At 55, he was unemployed and worried that he'd never work again. Then last year, his sister told him about a job fair for tradespeople happening in Cork.
I was unemployed for a year and a half. Basically, I did usual round of the job market in Ireland. To no avail. I was 55 years of age, on the scrap heap of life as such. So I was grateful for the opportunity. I'm enthusiastic about Canada. I love it. The people are so nice. Everybody that I work with are so nice. It's just a great country. I wish I was 26 years of age instead of 56 years of age.
Mm. What is the hardest part about being away from Ireland, working in British Columbia for you, Danny?
There's a couple of things that I miss about, a lot of things I miss about Ireland, actually. I miss the sporting life because I'm a huge sports fan. I miss my friends. I had a large circle of friends. And most of all, I miss my daughter and my son. I miss those an awful lot.
I mean, we actually had to squeeze this interview in with you early in the morning, your time, because you have to be on the job at 5:30. And it sounds pretty demanding. What exactly are you doing?
I'm in Millerite. So what I do is we install conveyors. The company I work for, we install conveyors. It's physical work. The rewards are fantastic. You have free healthcare in Canada. I'm on $37 an hour. It's a unionized job. The job itself is fantastic.
Let me just jump in. How does that $37 an hour compare with what you would be making for an equivalent job back in Ireland?
Oh, fantastic. It's way more than what you make in the construction industry back home. Plus, there's no jobs in the construction industry. And basically, I'm living the dream here.
Living the dream minus your family, though, that's got to be kind of tough. I mean, do you imagine going back to Ireland at some point?
No, I cannot imagine myself going back to Ireland. The lifestyle here is too good. I have a beautiful apartment here, which I'm renting. This is a city where you have the mountains 20 minutes away. You can ski. You have the sea 20 minutes away. You can be on a beach. Everything is so good here.
Let me just ask you one more thing, Danny. I mean, you're one of these pawns in this 21st century global economy, and, you know, you're going where the jobs are, not where you necessarily want to be, although it sounds like it's working out and you want to be in British Columbia. I'm just wondering what that feels like to kind of not really going into this, have much free choice.
You have a choice. I could stay at home. I could get on unemployment benefit, but that's not for me. And listen, Marco, the global area such as shrunk. You can get flights home, which are relatively cheap. It's not as if you're getting on a boat and just heading off, which they did in the 1920s and 30s, and you'd never see Ireland again. You have so much communication. You can Skype. You can telephone. You're on a computer. You can email. The world is a small place. If I needed to go to another country after this to get work, I'll do it. I like working. I like being useful and putting something back into the economy, you know, and make new life for myself.
Well, Danny O'Sullivan, best of luck to you. I hope it all continues to go your way in British Columbia. Thanks for speaking with us.
Marco, it's a pleasure, and I hope your day and everybody else's day in America goes well.
News headlines are next. This is The World from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, if you've ever taken a CPR class and you've probably touched lips with Annie, she's the life-size doll used since the 1950s for life-saving classes, and her creator was a Norwegian toy maker named Asmund Lærdal.
It could have been a man or a woman. Asmund felt that a woman's face would be less threatening.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates premieres October 28th at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. There was a memorial today for the hundreds of African migrants who died when their boat sank just off the coast of Italy. These were men, women, and children, but the service wasn't the state funeral that Italian leaders had promised, and it wasn't on the island of Lampedusa where the bodies came ashore. Reporter Valeria Fernandez is a Phoenix-based reporter who often covers stories about the U.S.-Mexico border. But a week ago today, she was in Lampedusa. Valeria, why did you go to Lampedusa in the first place?
Well, I was in Italy on vacation for almost a month. and I was there to learn Italian. And when I heard the news, it was October 3rd, I was in Florence, and it shocked me, it struck me, being that I come from a border state and I've been covering immigration issues for the last decade, I really couldn't help but go.
So you get to the island of Lampedusa, and what did you see? What were people telling you?
Well, I'm in the plane about to land, and the first thing that strikes me is that one of the passengers says in Italian that there is no fishermen in the sea. He sees no lights. And the reason is because the fishermen are afraid of throwing their nets and catching bodies of people that drown, bodies that have yet to be rescued. And, you know, that gives you a sense of the state of mind of the local people and the degree of trauma and shock that they were experiencing. Just a few hours later, after I land, some of the local people take me to the port to show me what was going on. And I arrived to this scene. There were all these coffins being transported into a Navy boat, dozens and dozens of them.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that would just completely consume the island. I mean, that's probably all they think about and talk about for weeks.
This is exactly what's going on. I mean, you get in the bus, the radio is on talking about it. You go to a restaurant and you see it because you have the local people mingling, you know, sharing food, trying to help these refugees. And the refugees are everywhere in the island. And the thing is, there is this degree of solidarity and generosity coming from Lampedusans that is really, you know, heartwarming to see in the midst of the tragedy.
I was just going to say, so how bottomless is that generosity?
Well, I mean, there is a sense of frustration from the locals, and especially the business owners, but it's not with the refugee, but it's with the Italian government, the European community. They feel alone. They feel that the state is absent. So I sense a lot of frustration. The island livelihood is tourism. So you have hundreds of journalists, politicians that were coming, giving speeches, talking about the situation. And Lampedusa, on the headlines, is known as the island of death. You know, I was talking to one of the women that helped in the rescue. She was there in a boat near the island, just, you know, having a nice evening with her friends. She heard the sound of what she thought were seagulls. Then it sounded like a party on the middle of the sea. They walked out and they see three people in the water. And when they turn around, they realize it's dozens, hundreds that are swimming. And they help 47 of them get into this tiny, tiny little boat as they call the coastal guard and for support. I mean, this is how raw the situation was and how close it was to the island.
Valeria, you report from the U.S.-Mexico border, as we said, and, you know, it's your curiosity from that beat that, in a way, drove you to Lampedusa while you're on vacation in Italy. That filter through which you watch what was happening at Lampedusa, what did you specifically see in terms of parallels? I mean, what were you reminded of what you covered down in the southwest of the U.S.?
I see a lot of parallels. The experience of a small community, just like we have, you know, communities here in Arizona, that are sort of catapulted or thrown into the middle of a much larger, very explosive immigration debate. And I think that sometimes their voices go unnoticed. So there's frustration, they are tired, but what they want is not for the migrants to go away and be deported, like we often hear in Arizona, is they want a solution, an international solution to a problem that is global and that they can't resolve at the local level, because it's not enough to just, you know, feed these refugees with a plate of food and give them a place to sleep.
I'm wondering, was there a moment when you were in Lampedusa where you just stopped and said, wow, this is exactly like Southwest U.S., this is exactly like Arizona?
Well, just when you talk to the survivors and they tell you the reasons why they're coming to Europe, they have a family in Eritrea that they want to support, and they know that just having one person in Europe can make a difference between life and death in their country. And it's the same story that I hear in Spanish when I talk from people from Central America and Mexico. They want to give their families a better life, and that's why they're risking everything they have, and they're not afraid to death. And this is the thing, this is the biggest parallel of all, is once the tragedy happened, they turn the page and they're ready to move on because they have so much at stake that all they can do is look forward. I mean, this young man, he just told me, he said, I can't dwell now on what happened. I have to think now, my joy now is thinking that I will eventually make it to Norway, and that will save my family that's in Eritrea. So it's you see the same thing in Arizona when, you know, women are assaulted. It oftentimes in the desert, people go through a lot of hardship. Once they arrive in Arizona, very few of them want to look back and talk about it. It's all about moving forward to help their family.
Valeria Fernandez is a Phoenix-based reporter who covers the U.S.-Mexico border. She's just returned from the Italian island of Lampedusa, site of a recent immigrant boat wreck that killed more than 300 people. Valeria, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
You can learn a lot from a dummy. So goes the tagline to a car commercial whose crash test dummies take the heat of a crash so you don't have to. Well, we're about to learn a whole lot from a dummy, or rather about a dummy. This dummy may be the most kissed woman in the world. Get your minds out of the gutter. The story is not what you think. This one starts in the 19th century when the body of a drowned woman was pulled from the Seine in Paris. A pathologist was so smitten with the unknown woman's face that he made a plaster cast of it. Long story short, that face, with its Mona Lisa-like smile, eventually became the face of the CPR dummy most of us are familiar with. She's got many names, CPR Annie, Rescue Annie, Resuscite Anne, whatever her name, millions have put their lips on her. The BBC's Jeremy Grange has documented Rescue Annie's story. So fill in the blanks for us, Jeremy, between this inconnu, this unknown drowning victim, to her renown as a CPR dummy. How'd you go from a mask to this mannequin?
It's an interesting story. It goes back to the 50s. There was a guy called Asmund Leerdal, who was a Norwegian toy manufacturer. But his little boy, Tore, when he was two, came close to drowning, I think possibly in the family pond. And his father saw this and rescued him just in time and managed to get the water out of his lungs and saved his little boy's life. Fast forward a few years, Asmund Leerdal was approached by Peter Safer, who had come up with the idea of CPR, and he was looking for a way of devising a training aid, and together they developed Resuscite Anne. But there was this question of, you know, okay, what sort of face do we give this figure? You know, initially it could have been a man or a woman. Asmund felt that a woman's face would be less threatening. And then Asmund remembered a mask that had been on the wall of his grandparents' house, as it had been on the wall of so many other people's houses, you know, across Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that was the inconnu. So he just took that mask and used it, had to adapt it slightly because the inconnu, of course, has her mouth closed, and for CPR you need an open mouth, but that's how the mask became the face of Rescue Annie.
Jeremy, it's a fascinating story. You first wrote about it back in 2009, and since then you've come upon two intriguing postscripts. Tell us the first one.
A few weeks after the program had gone out, and I was visiting an old photographic studio, which in the early 20th century had been where everybody in Liverpool went to have their proper family portraits taken. On the wall of the waiting room was the mask of the inconnu. So I, you know, it was a little disingenuous, but I said to the guide, oh, what's that? Mm-hmm. And immediately, you know, without, you know, not missing a beat, she started telling me the story of two sisters, identical twins from Liverpool, who had, well, one of them had gone to Paris, perhaps run off with a lover, eloped to Paris and disappeared. And her sister never heard from her again. 50 years later, the sister is on holiday. She's in Paris. She's walking down a street and she sees outside one of these cast makers' workshops a mask. And she recognizes it immediately as her sister and, you know, kind of remains forever young through this mask while the other sister has grown old. And I was told this story and realized how people love the story so much that they want to kind of appropriate it and make it their own. And they turn what is a kind of French story into something that's relates to Liverpool.
Yeah. Everybody wants a piece of this story now.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very difficult not to start weaving tales around it. And that's kind of where the other postscript comes from.
Yeah, that involves an Oxford-based artist named John Goto, right?
That's it. He was a contributor to the program that I made, and he was talking about how he'd played with the idea again. And he'd actually set up online a kind of evidence that somebody had actually found out who the Inconnu was. And what it came down to was it identified the Inconnu as a Hungarian nightclub singer and actress called Eva Laszlo, who was murdered by her lover. This was all a fiction, and, you know, John didn't really intend it to be anything else. He'd set it there as a piece of art, just to play with the idea. But just this week for European Restart a Heart Day, in the evening there was a kind of performance, theatre, musical performance. And on the blurb advertising this performance, it said, you know, I quote, "It tells the story of Eva Laszlo, who became the inspiration for the face of Resusian, the first CPR training mannequin, the most kissed girl in the world." And this just idea, this fiction that John had put online, was now being appropriated as fact. So, you know, people just can't leave the story alone. And, you know, part of the reason I wrote an article about it, just to remind people that, no, we don't know who the Inconnu is. And in a way, do we really want to know? Because we could have so much more fun with just letting our imaginations run with the idea of the unknown woman of the Seine.
The BBC's Jeremy Grange, thanks so much for telling us the story and many different fictions. Appreciate your time.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
We're going to hear briefly from Australia now, where, just as in some parts of the U.S., people are used to wildfires. But the fires raging across many parts of southeastern Australia right now are the worst in decades. Some are within 50 miles of Sydney. And there's concern that, as temperatures and winds pick up over the next couple of days, several of the fires could merge. The BBC's John Donison went with Australia's RFS, the Royal Fire Service, to one of the most affected areas.
Well, it's morning now. You might be able to hear the whir of helicopters. They're choppers that are being used to dump water on some of the fire fronts not far from here. And I've been speaking to one volunteer firefighter, Michael McCurvey, about the task in hand in his sector.
At the moment, we've got a couple of sections we're trying to chase in. It's looking quite difficult for us, yeah.
Compared to fires in the past, I mean, people are saying this is the worst fire in a decade. Is that your assessment?
Historically speaking, the behaviour of the fire at the moment would probably date back to 1936, since we've had fires that have been as bad as this.
And I guess the big difference from 1936 was you have a lot more people living in this area now.
We have a lot more people here, but the other thing is we have a lot more resources as well. A lot of firefighters from all over the country are here helping us, so that's good. That's outstanding. So we'll see how we go over the next couple of days.
And most of the firefighters, volunteers?
Everybody that you'll see floating around from the RFS are all volunteers. The majority of the people out here are losing time off work to come and do this.
And the weather forecast, you can feel it today. It's already a lot hotter. We've got strong winds forecast later in the week. How significant is that?
Well, the weather conditions are certainly deteriorating for us. If we can, try and get good solid containment on all of our fires before the weather turns really bad for us. But we'll see how we go.
Well, you only have to come a mile down the road to find that for scores of families, the damage has already been done. On this street, I'm just picking through the rubble of what was once a fine-looking home, looking out over the bush, now completely flattened. Elsewhere in the state, as fires continue to burn, there's a sense this week that things could get worse before they get better.
The BBC's John Donison reporting from New South Wales, Australia. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. In theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. By day, Carl Sciarro is a Lebanese architect living and working in London. By night, he's the guy behind Carl Remarks, a satirical blog about the Middle East. It's kind of a Middle East onion, but more subtle than that. For example, he's got a section on his blog called Three Dictators Walk Into a Bar. Here's a sample. So, three members of Egypt's Electoral Commission walk into a bar. Sorry, you have to wait a few hours for the punchline. Yeah, it's a good one. Don't have to be Egyptian to get it. I spoke with Carl Remarks recently, and I asked him about his habit of having debates about his work on Twitter.
Listen, this thing about Twitter, I mean, I love it because it allows you to engage and you discover all sorts of really great people who are very smart. But occasionally you get someone who's completely sort of, for lack of any other word, just out there to provoke and in a very dumb and superficial way. And I think it's almost like becomes like a mental exercise that you have to engage with them and rebut their accusations. And
give me some examples of how you engage with your followers, and you don't have to use names.
So I was recently talking to someone and I pointed out what I thought were very obvious personality flaws about him. And he goes, a line that a lot of people use on Twitter, you can't resort to insult just to win an argument. And I said, listen, in this instance, it's not an insult, it's diagnosis. So it's that kind of line that keeps you into this sharp kind of banter mode that I like about it.
I was intrigued to hear you say that you were really impressed with Woody Allen's early stand-up comedy. And as I was reading through Three Dictators Walk Into a Bar, there was something, and I couldn't put my finger on it, but there was something very American about your style. How would you describe Woody Allen's early form of stand-up that you really like?
I think the breakthrough about it was, from a historic point of view, is before that you listened to stand-up comedians and they were funny, but they tended to be less highbrow. What Woody Allen did is he took it to that extreme level, if you like, of a mixing comedy and highbrow or intellectual kind of approach, that he would be talking about philosophy and mix it up with a different setting and then kind of come up with a completely different way of looking at comedy. And I think that it was this great sort of boldness in saying, I can take comedy and deal with philosophy and deal with all these big questions of life and create this absurd situation. I think that was the attraction. I mean, it's sadly not something that he went on to focus on, because obviously his main interest in life was making films. But I think if you read it in his early writing and if you listen to his stand-up comedy, he creates this absolutely absurd situations that I try to sort of learn from. So, for example, when I write about my guides, and this is something that I do frequently, so I would do a guide for the moderate rebels in Syria, because everybody is talking, who are the moderates? And it would include things like the Red Unicorn Brigades and other mythical brigades. A lot of that is inspired by Woody Allen's way of thinking and kind of approach to comedy. And I think it's very, very universal, but it does obviously have that American resonance to it.
Yeah, it's a certain absurdist reference too, which I personally appreciate. You also write in Arabic, though, don't you? I mean, do you translate from one to the other, or are you working in two different orbits, in English and then another in Arabic?
Well, I do it both ways. So sometimes if a particular post is successful, I'll take it and translate it into Arabic. But generally, I think I've experimented with that a lot, but it needs more work than straightforward translation, because the humor is different in Arabic.
Do you get feedback that's different from each group? The English readers and the Arabic readers?
Yeah, a lot of the Arabic readers are completely brutal, because this is so absurd. Why did you even waste your time writing this? Which is brilliant. I love getting these comments because it's got complete honesty. And it's almost like, to some people, it's not even imaginable. Why would you even go about doing that?
Give us an example of like kind of a joke that the Arabic audience just doesn't get.
You know, the Higgs received the Nobel Prize for discovering the so-called God particles. So I tweeted that the leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri, was full of remorse when he heard the news about the discovery of the God particle. And he said, we've been wrong about everything we've been doing. And he broke down in tears. And it was, to me, just like this absurd situation, you know, as if science can defeat zealotry or fundamentalism. So I got a response in Arabic from someone saying, is this a joke? And you sometimes put a voice to these things, because you're like, how am I supposed to reply now? And it was like, genuinely, it felt like a serious question.
So he wasn't being sarcastic. It was just
no,
like,
no, it wasn't.
It
wasn't
me?
Being
but
sarcastic.
It was
like,
what's
a serious. Is this a joke? So it's kind of just like the instances where you feel that the humor isn't really translating at all. Or I mean, maybe it's lame humor. Who knows? But it's just not resonating at all. And I love that because people will say that to you, which I think it happens in Arabic much more than it happens in English. It keeps you on your toes if you do something silly, which inevitably you do all the time. I mean, I must irritate people so much, you know, who follow me on Twitter or whatever, because you have to experiment. You have to find new ways of being funny or whatever. You can't just rely on a formula. And a lot of that is hit and miss.
What was your most successful joke that kind of you felt was really funny and got a lot of response?
I mean, posting-wise, I think at some point I was really frustrated with Lebanon, the politics of Lebanon, how everything can be so absurd about it. And I came up with this idea of a fake news story that The Onion, the satirical, you know, American magazine, is suing Lebanon because it's making its headlines sound totally plausible. I was trying for a long time to make a bar joke about three dictators. And then one day when, you know, we had realized that the Muslim Brotherhood were winning a lot of the elections, and I said, so Gaddafi, Mubarak, and Ben Ali, who was the president of Tunisia, walk into a bar after they left, the Muslim Brotherhood won the elections and closed the bar down. It was kind of a way to sum up the Arab Spring so far. I mean, little did we know. We thought that was the end. And that was really one of the most successful jokes.
Lebanese satirist Carl Sharrow goes by the name Carl Remarks when he is playing his satirical persona. Carl, great to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can hear more from Carl Remarks, including his imagined dialogue between new pen pals President Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. That's all at PRI.org. Humor has exploded in the Mideast since the Arab Spring. Pre-Arab Spring, dictators tried to keep a lid on it. I want to leave you today with a note about a different sort of pre-revolutionary vibe, this one from the days when Iran was still run by the Shah. Back then, there was so much love for the West in Iran, weird Western musical sounds were embraced. In other words, bring on the funk and the psychedelia. This modest example, thank Burt Bacharach, travels to Tehran, is from singer Nushara Farin. It's from a new collection titled Gush Bede, Funk, Psychedelia, and Pop from the Iranian Pre-Revolution Generation. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow. یه مسافر غریب دل به دریا زد و از جاده گذشت شهر تنهایی رو زیر پا گذاشت همه یه پنجره های بسته رو به روی The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.